everybody. It is Katie Kestner. I am the primary host of the Dear Katie podcast, and we are so delighted to have you take this journey with us on our weekly podcast episodes. I just want to remind everyone to do great self-care. Thriving is part of the purpose of this podcast, and we definitely want you to take a break at any time. Warm bath, fresh air, walk a dog, have a bite of chocolate, whatever you need to do good care for yourself. Just as a reintroduction, if you're not familiar with me, I am the woman who was on the cover of Time magazine at age 18 as the first in history to speak out nationally and publicly as the victim of date rape. And HBO made a film about me, and I went on to become the executive director of the Take Back the Night Foundation. We are the oldest, largest global movement on sexual violence in all forms for all people in the world. So we encourage you to visit our website for lots more information. So I'm going to turn it over to our host and our guest for today. Welcome back to the Dear Katie podcast. This is Katie Kestner.
And this is Claire Kaplan. Once again, I want to remind our listeners that sometimes we have difficult discussions on the podcast that can be hard for folks who've gone through trauma. So we want to encourage all of you to care for your safety and well-being, whether it's to reach out for emotional support from family or friends, or a counselor, or even a hotline. Additional resources can be found on the Take Back the Night Foundation website, and I'll share that address with you at the end of the podcast.
Thank you so much, Claire. And we have a special guest today who doesn't identify as a survivor, but is here to share his wealth of knowledge around the legal field in sexual violence. He is an attorney and lives in Canada, and he'll introduce himself. His name is Ben Perrin. So Ben, we are so delighted to host you on the podcast. Can you share a little more about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you so much, Katie. So I'm a criminal law professor in Vancouver, Canada, at the University of British Columbia. I first got started, I guess, really, you know, grew up quite a wonderful, loving middle-class home. I didn't have any exposure to the issues that I came to be concerned about and research. It was only when my mom actually started volunteering and in fact working at a center for abused women and kids and in Calgary, Alberta. And one day she came home. I was a teenager at the time, and I had done some babysitting and things like that. And so they needed some support with the kids. So they'd have a weekly group session with the moms, and they needed someone to come and essentially provide childcare. And so I said yes, not thinking anything of it. I thought I know how to babysit kids. I was the oldest of four kids, and just would show up. And I was immediately sort of taken when I walked in the door as a young man, even as a, you know, teenage man, young boy, really still, at how some of the kids were so standoffish. I immediately understood why. They had either witnessed, and many of them had experienced physical and sexual abuse at the hands of abusive fathers and partners. And so it was really the first time that I saw that kind of reaction from kids. And I'd never seen that before. And it was really striking. Many of them had came to know, had, you know, never seen, had really kind of any kind of healthy or, you know, positive or even safe male figure in their life. And so,
Wow. Yeah,
it was quite a thing.
How did you, I guess I have a quick question about that.
Yeah.
What you said is so perceptive as a teenager to notice that about the peer group you're around. What struck you about anything in terms of their personalities or issues with control or trust or, you know, what was your perception back then and now your reflection now?
I remember at the time, I remember knowing that this is probably why. I just kind of had a sense of it because it was so different. I'd babysat a lot of kids, you know, kind of family, friends, neighbors, things like that. I'd been to summer camp and done that sort of thing. And what I noticed with these kids is, it took them many weeks, maybe even a couple of months to start to just play with me the way that the other kids would play. You know, there's a little playground in the backyard. I remember the room we were in. they often were kind of keeping, like physically keeping distance, right? There'd be like a corner in a room and they'd have, you know, some books or toys, and then I'd see that and they wouldn't come over. And I'm a pretty silly guy. One of my summer jobs around this time, or maybe it was a year or two before this, was they had this kind of silly job in the city I was in of trying to educate kids about not vandalizing property. And they had us doing it with puppets, you know, so we had these kind of like,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was really funny. It was really cute. So I had puppets. I often, my wife still laughs today. She says, if there's a baby, I can get it to smile. I just make a lot of goofy faces and smile. Like I said, I think it's because I was the oldest of four kids. You know, my youngest sister was 9 years old. So I grew up kind of like helping out a bit, but yeah, so there's some things like that. But I, you know, the kids eventually came to open up a bit. And one of the young boys in particular, I guess he would have been around 11 or so. Later on, after I had stopped volunteering there, actually, after I don't know how long I was there, maybe a year or so, I heard through my mom, I said, he just would love to like kind of connect again. And, you know, you guys want to go to like a hockey game or something, or, you know, just kind of do something positive, kind of like a big brother type thing, right? And I did that for a few years, just kind of meeting off and on, not a lot, but, and I kind of wonder what happened with him, you know, but those are the kinds of things that I noticed. And, but eventually, you know, once they saw that, you know, there was trust there and it was a very safe environment, we're all in one big room. There was always other adults, you know, you're never alone with these kids. And, a lot of it was outside and stuff like that. And they were really wonderful kids. And I look back and I really do see that was the start of my understanding that, you know, the world was a lot more difficult and dangerous for other children. And so I guess I'll flash forward a little bit just to bring up the other kind of big thing is, you know, I'm not a survivor myself, but my wife is a survivor of childhood abuse, physical abuse and neglect quite severely. So, and she's given me permission to share about that. And because it's a big part of it has been my journey is understanding, you know, in relationship with someone as an adult who's a survivor of that kind of abuse, the ways in which it affects our relationship, the way it's affected us. And also, the really wonderful thing is the kind of healing and transformation that she's gone through and getting support over the years and that we've gone through in our marriage too. So, yeah.
Ben, I'm so glad you brought that up because I think that we have listeners or partners of survivors who have partners who may or may not be feeling entirely supported because their partners don't completely understand what they're going through and or don't know how, really. It's not that it's necessarily intentional. And so I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about what I know you want to talk about your work and I want to hear about that, but I also, since you are the partner of a survivor who had some pretty severe trauma, what are just a couple of things you might want to suggest?
Yeah, sure. So my wife and I have been together for 22 years now. She's been diagnosed with complex trauma and ADHD and OCD and a couple other issues as well. But those are the main things that came up. But we didn't know this. And it does link to my work because when I started doing research into childhood trauma and the way that it impacts people, for example, in some cases turning to substances or its connection with mental health issues later in life, it's where I first learned about the ACEs research, the Adverse Childhood Experiences research. And, right. You know, I brought that home to my wife because I was doing the research at work and I said, hey, this is kind of wild. Like, look at this. There's 10 questions and it's, you know, shows the kind of correlations that can happen with folks. It's not predetermined, but it can have these massive impacts. And she said, let me take a look at it. She went down and I didn't check any of them. I was 0 for 10. And she went down and I think she's 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. And she said, isn't that funny? Or she said this at the time. She said, isn't that funny? I had 5 or 6 of them and you're telling me that most folks will have all these big impacts and it hasn't impacted me at all. Well, flash forward a year or two later and we found ourselves in the middle of a kind of midlife crisis is the best way to put it. And that's when it all started coming out. We started realizing that there was so much going on below the surface in pretty much every difficult interaction we would have in our marriage, there would be, you know, her trauma triggering and interacting with my issues. I didn't experience childhood abuse, but I'd experienced some bullying, had some pretty big self-worth issues. And so I would take any little kind of criticism really negatively. and kind of want to walk off. And she wanted to be close and attached to me. She didn't want me walking off. And other things I would notice too were I'd be talking at a regular volume maybe, and but my tone would be very negative or harsh. And she would say, stop yelling at me. And I said, I'm not yelling at you. And so, you know, there were differences of perception. And the really disturbing thing was, as we saw at support and counseling, couples counseling, three out of the four counselors we had made it worse. They did not understand complex trauma either. At one point, they told me that, you know, I should just walk away from the relationship. And this is, she had severe mental health disorders, probably undiagnosed. It was all her trauma. And once she got healing from a properly qualified trauma counselor, in my experience, they all say they know about trauma, but very few do. Then she was able to along with the work I was doing in my life too, I had a lot of work to do as well. We were able to come back together, and you know, we renewed our vows 2.5 years ago with our kids, and have new rings, and we have a really kind of a new life and a second marriage. And it's a wonderful thing to go through healing with someone you love.
That is so amazing. I know, Claire. I'm like, this is great.
That's so great.
I'm going to make my husband listen to this tonight, Ben. I'm not waiting for it to be released.
Well,
he needs to know what it's like to be married to me, because we're like living parallel lives. We have two kids.
Yeah.
He's a lawyer.
Oh, wow.
Too.
Wow.
Yes.
This is wild.
I'm just telling you.
Wild.
It's so cool. I'm so excited. I do have one thing though, just for reference for our listeners.
Sure.
That was beautiful. I have two follow-ups. One is the timeline that process took. So, you know, some people might be listening to you and think it all happened within 6 months or a year or 5 years or 10 years. They might not know how long and how invested you have to be in that process of understanding trauma. So what did your timeline look like?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, and it's obviously different for everyone, but I would say this, her working on her issues and me working on my issues, which for me included, you know, multiple addictions and undiagnosed, you know, high functioning autism and a bunch of other things as well. So we're both working on our own stuff and then trying to work together. It was 2.5 years from when we first separated for a short period of time to when we renewed our vows, and we ended up, that was not a straight line, you know, as anyone knows, right? There's a lot of ups and downs, but I'm really grateful. And, you know, our faith played a big part in that. It, you know, we both say we made a mess of our marriage, but, you know, God really stepped into the breach and saved us. And the other thing I'd mention too, that really was helpful, was I did find, actually, it's pretty rare, but I did find someone at the time who was a complex trauma partner's support coach. So that's pretty rare.
Wow.
Yeah.
And yes.
Really rare. And
how did you find that person?
Well, my wife found her, and, you know, I was pretty leery, but I thought, well, you know what, how could it hurt? And I was quite desperate at that time. And I had just several sessions with her, and she was someone with that experience as well. And just walked through with me what her journey looked like. And she's still on it as well. I've since stayed in touch with her. My wife actually got to meet her a few weeks ago. We were traveling and we got to meet her and thank her for her support. But one of the big things that helped me a lot was understanding, like, what's the work that my wife can only do on her own and with her counselor and her support team. And what's the part that I need to step up for as a partner. And part of the problem was that I was, she was expecting me to do things that I really couldn't do, you know, and understanding like where my role as a partner begins and ends, and getting out of the enmeshment and the entanglement that we were, you know, it used to be, if she was happy, I was happy. If she was sad, I was sad. And so, you know, we don't have that anymore. We've, you know, there's a term, differentiation. We're our own people, but we're in this healthy marriage. So when we come to this marriage now, this relationship, we're, you know, healing, not fully healed, but we're healing people. And we're not looking for each other to fill the holes in our heart. We've done the work to do that. We, like I said, our faith is a big part now in our marriage. And, you know, that way, when we come in the relationship, we're not coming, like, you know, coming out of the desert, as it were, desperate for water. We're coming in instead. We're like, hey, this is all bonus. Our relationship is like more fun and amazing. And And we make time now. We make time to talk about our feelings. We make time every, you know, week or two for date night. We make time once a year to go away and leave the kids with grandparents and go somewhere fun. And so we had to learn to do that. No one teaches you this stuff, right? And so I'm very grateful that we were able to do that. And it's really relevant to my work, because most of my, you know, 90% of my understanding about trauma came from this experience and doing the reading and understanding about childhood trauma from a person who I love so much and who survived that. And that I then brought that into the work as I was.
I want to get to work, but I have two last questions to follow up, because we're almost there. I think another term that you use is complex trauma specialist. And I don't know that a lot of people understand what that might be defined as. And I'm going to say what I think, but you need to clarify. Usually complex trauma means it refers to things that are lots of different forms of trauma. It can be different types: sexual, emotional, physical abuse. It could also mean abuse that is all of those things that has happened over the entire course of one's life at various points. Is that accurate to what you were referring to, or did I not define it so well?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's kind of an emerging term. I mean, one of the reasons that I understand that it's not yet in the, some people will know about the DSM-5, right? The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
Right.
And one of the reasons I've heard why it's not in there is because you can't treat it with medication, right? So this is like one of the rationales for it. But I'm pretty sure it's in the World Health Organization has a separate
list. Right? Were you exposed to that? I think it's EMDR.
Sure. Yep. Yeah, EMDR is one of the ways. There's also like a lot of somatic therapies that are done, so body movement therapy. I've done some EMDR on some of the bullying stuff I mentioned, and I've found it helpful. My wife doesn't do EMDR, but she does a lot of the movement, and it's called somatic therapy. So it's basically, you know, folks are probably familiar with that book, The Body Keeps the Score. We do keep a lot of our, you know, our trauma in our bodies, and being able to get that out and move with that really, really has been helpful for my wife. So yeah, finding someone, like I said, everyone says they do trauma work. Like, you won't find a counselor who doesn't say, "Oh, I get trauma." So that's not enough.
Right. Yeah. I hear you.
You have to ask what modalities they do and see what works for you. Right. And yeah.
One thing about complex trauma, and as you said, you know, there's, it manifests in different ways, certain forms of complex trauma. And I'm not surprised to hear that your wife did not do EMDR, because it doesn't work for complex trauma very well. And as a family member of someone who has that, it just, like, the therapist says, don't do it. It's not going to work. And it's just going to, it could be worse. So I think people have to be careful when they talk to therapists. EMDR is really good for a lot of trauma experiences, but for stuff that's super deep and very complex, it may be, it can be just triggering, even more triggering.
Yeah.
Okay, so my last question before we head to your work, which is incredible, Ben. But the other thing I think might help our listeners, I'm just trying to be practical oftentimes and accessible so our listeners can like listen, learn, apply, and consider everything that we put forth on the podcast. So another kind of practical question that I think we've not talked about, it's this, you know, you needed therapy, you said, or counseling or support on some issues. Your wife had different issues. And then you also, you said marriage counseling. Sometimes I think people are like, how many counselors do we need to have? Yeah. Do you need some for your kids? Because they're traumatized. Like, the kids need theirs. I need mine. Like, how do we all come together? How are counselors all sharing notes? Like, I think that's a practical kind of question.
Yeah.
But I think your experience, at least, is a firsthand one. Like, in your experience, how did you all do the multiple therapists, if you had one, and how did they communicate? You know, just so our listeners can say, like, oh, that's how you do that.
Yeah. So we did have our initial sort of getting started thing was, we had a person who was like a kind of crisis marriage counselor, just to sort of stabilize things and all that. And that was just sort of like a 1 week intensive type of thing. That was pretty quick and then over quickly. My wife has had her own therapist who, you know, it's always good to get a friend, right? So the issue that we've found with how we live our lives now is we're really honest and upfront with our friends and the people around us. And you'd be amazed when you do that, how many people will then come to you when life isn't good, right? Hmm. If they think you got it all together, and boy, did we look like we had it all together. No one's coming to you telling you about their issues. But we have, you know, multiple wonderful, you know, friends and people we're close to, or even friends of friends who, you know, when relationship things hit the fan, they'll say, oh, you should, you know, talk to these guys. So we'll talk to them. I'll talk to the husband. My wife will talk to the wife. And sometimes it's a one-time thing over coffee. And sometimes it lasts for years now where we just share our story. You know, it's about giving people hope, it's breaking that isolation. You know, as a man, I can say, like, you know, I didn't have any close friends before, really didn't. I'd have guys I'd go, you know, go watch a movie with, and you don't talk to anyone at the movie theater and have a drink or whatnot. But now I do. Through this journey, I've got to know and become really close with a number of guys. So we were not in counseling continuously for that time. At sometimes it was helpful, at sometimes it wasn't. And so it was about finding the right people and at the right time. But so we did have some couples counselors that were unhelpful, like I said, but one or two that were really good and helped us to, I think, slow things down. They helped us to understand each other so we could both feel heard and listened. We also did some counseling called Imago. I don't know if you've heard of that one. That was super helpful to give us some very basic tools around just things like, you know, stuff like, hey, what I hear you saying is, you know, X, Y, Z. Did I get that right? No, you didn't get that right. Okay, can you explain some more to me? And, you know, just so, even just being heard and understanding your partner is so important. And like I said, we don't get the tools for this. No one teaches this stuff. So it definitely was expensive. I mean, counseling is really expensive. And so we had to take on some debt for it. But my approach was, you know, divorce was so much more costly and painful, not just for us and our kids, but even just on a straight up financial basis, that we wanted to do everything we could to try to make it work. And, you know, also not bring the issues that we had into our next relationship if we did end in divorce. Right. So, yeah. So I think the number one thing for folks is to really not lose heart, you know, reach out for help. Don't be surprised if other people have issues too going on. And, you know, it's a wonderful way to live, you know, honestly, transparently, authentically with folks. And, you know, takes a lot of pressure off not to have to be perfect.
I am so grateful you shared all of that, Ben. I think it will help many of our listeners really think clearly about, you know, you are quite analytical, but the one thing I'll land on before we turn to your work is I can only imagine the conversations going a little bit like, so you really want me to use two sentences instead of one?
Yeah.
Like, meaning my very practical partner sometimes is like, can you just get to the point? Can you say to one thing, what's the definition of is? You know, because lawyers have a certain way of thinking that's very linear.
Yeah.
And trauma is, as you already used the phrase, it's not a linear progression or step. So I think it messes with those of us who love math and science because there's not a clear outcome and a litmus test that can be easily passed or failed. So thank you for spending a little bit of your time tonight talking to us about that part of who you are and your work. So very grateful, Ben.
Well, thanks.
You're here. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, cheers. Okay, so now let's talk. I mean, so now you're in Vancouver. You are this amazing author, specialist, advocate. Talk to us about what you're doing with your work.
Yeah, so my work is in the area of like criminal law and criminal justice, and I do research and I talk to people. And most law professors in Canada and the U.S. don't do that. We're not even trained to do that, if you can believe it. So in law school and in graduate school, they don't teach you about any research methodology or ethics issues or anything around interviewing the people who are impacted. So you'll have people literally who, and I won't name names, but it's the way that the whole discipline is, who will write, you know, books on how the courts treat, you know, sexual assault survivors, but they won't speak to a single survivor. They'll read court cases and they'll read transcripts. These are the leading experts who are called before Congress or state legislatures or in Canada Parliament and give testimony around what our laws should be. They're on the media, in the news, they're on social media, and yet they haven't gone and talked to those people most impacted. And we see that for other issues too. I'm just pointing that one out because it's the kind of focus of your show. So I always kind of knew that was wrong, but didn't have much of an entry point into it. I had experience, interacting and working with survivors. My early work was on human trafficking. I did some work on that early in my career, and then started to look at the issue of the unregulated drug crisis, which in where I live right now is the leading cause of death for people ages 10 to 59 is unregulated drugs. And it disproportionately impacts Indigenous women. It's deeply connected to intergenerational trauma and childhood trauma. And my more recent work, the book that just came out in October, is called Indictment, the Criminal Justice System on Trial. And we basically put the justice system on trial, and the witnesses in the case are the people who've been most impacted by it. So we interviewed victims and survivors. We interviewed people who are incarcerated, as well as, people who work in and around the system. And, I can honestly say, I learned more from doing that than I did in the previous, 20 years attending conferences and doing all the traditional, kind of academic stuff. It was completely transformative for me in hearing their stories.
And I'm interested in when you would look for people to interview, did you do it through your own clientele or did you talk to colleagues and say, do you have anybody who would be interviewed, who'd be interested? How did you find folks?
So
a lot of people are shy about that stuff.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I wondered if people would want to share, if they want to actually tell their stories or what that would look like. And we obviously were concerned about not, re-traumatizing folks and all that. So what we did is we actually went through the entire federal database we have of victim service organizations. There's like over 100 of them, and sent them out our research poster, which basically had one big question. And it was in bold text, huge font. And it said, what was your experience like with the criminal justice system? That was it. What was your experience like? And I started getting contacted immediately. This went online. People started sharing it in their support groups and in their through Facebook messengers and all this stuff. And we just got completely flooded. And the two things that virtually everyone said, whether they were a survivor or they were someone who committed an offense, and there's actually a huge overlap between those two categories as well. Most of the people we spoke with who you would say is an offender or a criminal, they actually themselves are also survivors, almost invariably of childhood abuse, but also at the hands of police or corrections guards or fellow inmates. And so that's something else we could
wait. Talk Ben, about let me just interrupt for. I know you're like, we have to take one sentence at a time, literally. let's go back to. I talk a lot about that perpetrators are often victims when I speak all over the place.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of our listeners may necessarily understand that. And it might, I'm also thinking about some of them thinking, wow, should I feel less of a victim or more empathy toward my perpetrator if I know that they are also a victim themselves? So I think that's a kind of big topic.
Sure.
And it would be really important to talk about that. And only for another point of reference, I have one of my speeches. This is just, I try and share a little bit about my life journey for over 30 years since I'm 18. And one time I was speaking in Texas, Ben, and our listeners need to know, again, you're in Canada. But I showed up and I was in this auditorium at a university. And they said, by the way, all those three rows of men in the back, we brought them over from the prison. They're all convicted sex offenders. We brought them here as part of their, better understand a victim's point of view. Do you mind?
Wow. On the spot. Wow.
Yeah. It was like, do you mind? Like, There was no, like, Claire, hello, give a trigger warning.
Wow.
Like, trigger warning. Like, I need the darn trigger warning.
Yeah, that's really unfair.
But do you mind? And then the flip side of that story, Ben, is a long time ago, there was the wife of a Vice President, Tipper Gore. Al Gore was vice president at the time, and Tipper Gore invited me to come to speak with her in a maximum security prison in Connecticut to the women. It was a women's prison. So the other side of that coin is these were women who had then, they were abuse victims who had then gone on to either kill their perpetrators.
Yeah.
Or so it's so fascinating the work you're doing. And I think we could have many more conversations, but for our listeners, this is exploring a different part of your own healing, is to understand all the working pieces and all the complexities of trauma and perpetration and addiction and, all it's very complicated.
Yeah.
And so I would simply summarize and then toss it to you, Ben, for your response. Sometimes I think men are more likely to take their abuse and abuse others, and women who are abused are more likely to take their abuse and either victimize themselves, and at best, I'll say it, which is horrible, at best find the confidence to retaliate, which is a terrible thing to say. But often women turn their own hatred against, about what happened against themselves instead of pushing it somewhere that's helpful. And men often sink into this cycle of power and control of others. Mm. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a really tough one. I certainly won't tell anyone how to feel about their perpetrator. That's for them to think about and work through and all that. I mean, I think the issue I look at in my research is, my goal is to reduce harm in our society. Mm. We want to prevent harm. We want to prevent trauma. And in particular, we want to break the cycles of trauma and abuse that happen. And, one of the things that we found in the research is that, someone who experiences childhood trauma, they're at greater risk of being victimized later in life. One study says, right. Someone who's mm-hmm. experiences childhood trauma is actually 8 times more likely to be sexually victimized as an adult, right? So it increases your likelihood of that. But it also increases the risk of harming others, the hurt people saying that you often hear. It's not everyone, but it increases your risk by about 50%. So that's why a lot of what we talk about is trying to follow compassionate, evidence-based policies and programs that will support young families and children, right, to prevent that harm. So to look at, kind of flash forward, though, we're talking about where do people end up in this victim-offender overlap, as it's called. We have a really good criminological research center in Alberta, and they did a study of incarcerated people in the province of Alberta. Alberta is sometimes called, you mentioned Texas, the Texas of Canada, oil and...
yep, gotcha.
I grew up there. They had a stampede, and I had cowboy boots as a birthday present, so that's give people a sense of what Alberta's like. What that study found was that almost everyone, regardless of gender, who was incarcerated in the province were victims before becoming offenders. And the numbers really speak for that. I mean, you're looking at 95% of incarcerated Indigenous women and 86% of incarcerated Indigenous men had experienced victimization prior to being seen as offenders. And it was 90% for white women and 79% of white men incarcerated had these childhood and adolescent traumas. One thing I really want to emphasize, though, too, that we have found in our research, and I don't know if this research has been done in the U.S., but that really high number of proportion of women, it was higher than the men, you'll notice, right, who are experiencing trauma, who are now in jail, that a lot of that is related to what's called dual charging. And so that's when there's domestic violence situations. And if there's any suggestion that the female partner in the situation did anything remotely wrong or criminal in nature, they will just automatically charge both people. And that has been found to even our federal justice department, like the government itself has said, that has contributed to this massive disproportionate incarceration of indigenous women. Half of all women in Canadian federal institutions are indigenous, while they represent less than, you know, around 5 or 10% of the population, like 5% of the population. So,
right.
Yeah.
We had a very bad problem with that in the US, and probably in some jurisdictions is probably still a case, because the police were not trained to be able to determine what is an offense and a defensive injury. So they would just arrest both people when the laws, you know, the must arrest laws went through. That's changed a lot because they're trying to train people that, no, that's not quite how you do it. But I'm sure it's still a problem in a lot of areas. Yeah. And of course, Indigenous folks are often on the receiving end of a lot of that stuff. So,
yeah. I mean, we are very clear, like in the stuff that we do, and I'm no one's saying that because someone experienced trauma that will justify or excuse their behavior. But if we're serious about both healing for them and breaking these cycles, and if we're interested at a broad, you know, societal level of reducing harm to folks, we have to start doing a better job of supporting young families and protecting children. And there's really great, you know, research in the US around how to do that and programs that are working to do that. And it's not the case, you know, that every survivor or victim that we talked to had the same views on this. There was a range of views expressed, but, you know, by and large, what we heard from folks is they wanted to be heard. They didn't want to be treated like a piece of evidence. They wanted to be treated with dignity and respect. They wanted protection, and they wanted to be a part of the decision-making process around what happened with the person who had harmed them. They did not want to be forced to testify. That happened in many cases we talked to folks with. And they also wanted to not necessarily just see, you know, longer and longer sentences handed out. We talked to quite a few survivors who were quite adamant that they did not want the state taking on their role, and they wanted to be in the driver's seat and have options at least for some restorative justice and see the person who had harmed them actually get support and not just, you know, locked up. So it was a real range, and it was kind of surprising, to be honest, to hear that. But that's why you do research, is you learn from folks, and it can change your outlook.
There's been some good research also done in Australia around that issue, specifically about family violence and child abuse. And they found the same thing, that restorative justice was the choice that many people, especially in Indigenous communities, because that fits with their understanding of justice. You know, the harm is done to the survivor and also to the community, and fit very well with those traditions in Australia. So you might want to check that out too. I have a question. Mm-hmm. In the States, I went to a conference a few years ago about men in the anti-violence movement, both as survivors and as activists. And a number of male survivors spoke. And they talked about how their understanding that as they were growing up, that men who were sexually abused grew up to be become perpetrators. And so they never told anyone because they were terrified of, you know, even as adults getting therapy, they were afraid they were going to be labeled. And the research in the US actually shows that more men who are survivors do not become perpetrators than do.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to point that out. But also, when men end up in prison, it's not necessarily for abuse, it may be drugs. You know, and maybe something completely different than what we're thinking, you know, if men are in the criminal justice system. So I'm wondering what you think of that.
Yeah, in terms of the folks who end up, let's talk about that. That's great. So in fact, you know, I don't know what the reporting rates are like in the US, but it's essentially survivors of crime have given up on our criminal justice system. Only 1 in 3 people report crime. And when we look at sexual offenses, it's only 1 in 20, only 5%. And the best estimates we have are of you know, all of the sexual offenses that happen, less than 1% will get any kind of disposition or sentence handed down to the perpetrator. So the system has, I can't think of a, you know, better metric to measure the success of a system than the fact that the people who it's supposed to be there to protect have essentially walked away from it, and for many good reasons. That's something that's pretty shocking. When victimologists first started interviewing people in the 70s who were survivors, they were shocked because they found that that victims and survivors were even less satisfied with the criminal justice system than were the people who were charged with offenses. Hmm. That's an incredible finding, right? And I do the work in this book Indictment as we put the system on trial. We share common roots in both Canada and the U.S. We have adversarial criminal justice systems based on common law England, and the reason I argue in this book why the system is getting in many ways worse and not better, or at least it's just plodding along in a quite unsatisfactory way, is that it's sort of baked into the DNA of the system. And what I mean by that is everyone's probably heard the expression that a crime is a wrong against the state, right? You even see it in the cases. It doesn't have the victim's name or survivor's name. It's, state of California versus John Doe, or in our country, it's the king, if you can believe it. It's the king versus. So that is the root of it. That is about 1,000 years old, that idea, and it is at the root of the problem. And that is why, despite all the measures that I've supported over the years, including was one of the people who was first proposed, one of the architects of our Canadian Victims Bill of Rights Act, and have done international work in support of survivors and victims as well, that we still see these really horrible and awful situations. We've smoothed down some sharp edges, but it does something fundamentally wrong and sets us on the wrong foot when we say, no, that harm wasn't done to you. That's against the state. That leads to, that drives the whole system. It leaves survivors typically as outsiders. You may have some good cases, but I also noted many times how people who are more marginalized as survivors would tend to get less support, less care, less understanding. And it's devastating. The system simply is not set up to do a particularly good job of supporting victims and survivors. And that's something which I think should actually be at the heart of it. That's the main goal of the justice system should be not necessarily, punishment. We need to keep people safe, but the goal should be to transform the trauma in our society. And that means providing actual support and safety for survivors and resources for healing and recovery, and breaking those cycles of harm and violence in people who commit harm. And that, for example, just briefly, that what that means is when we do have to separate people from society and lock them up, that they would come out better human beings and not worse, that they're not in prisons where they're a subject, they're sharpening their shank at night, as one person described to me, waiting to get jumped in a public area of the prison, but they're actually getting themselves, they're also getting support for their issues. They're getting substance use support. They're getting vocational training. Most people in our country enter prison unemployed and leave unemployed. Most of them have a substance use disorder, up to 93% in some jurisdictions. And so we know that locking someone up, they're eventually going to get out. Most people do get out, and they tend to leave worse and not better. And that leaves all of us unsafe, right? They're higher risk of reoffending. So countries that have taken a more humane approach and dealt with the underlying causes see lower levels of reoffending. They go down from 60 to 70% reoffending down to just 20%, which is still awful for those folks who are harmed. But you can't deny the benefit of that to folks who are spared. Right now we just keep getting folks released in our country with high risk sex offender warnings. In our community, that happened recently. And what do you mean high? What have you been doing for the last 5 years with this person, right? So the system needs to go through a pretty wholesale overhaul, in my opinion. That's what I talk about in the book.
Great.
Awesome. Ben, we would love to chat and chat and chat, but here's what I'd like to propose. We are starting chapters of Take Back the Night at law schools. I know you're a professor at one, and we can chat later about that, but I wanted our listeners to at least know that part of staying active with Take Back the Night is joining an event, creating a chapter, and keeping connected with amazing folks like Ben. So for our listeners, I would definitely encourage you to get a hold of any of the works of Ben, follow him on social media, and absolutely be a part of the solution and do the brilliant, also personal work, Ben, that you've done independent from your public and national work. So thank you for joining us. We are delighted.
Well, thank you so much for everything you're doing. And I really enjoyed the conversation.
Same here.
Claire, can you close this out?
Yes, absolutely. So thank you again, Ben. This was really fascinating. I would love to talk with you more for sharing your work and your story. And also, thank you to all our volunteers who make this podcast possible. And thank you to our listeners for listening in today. Help us help other survivors by subscribing to the podcast, share it far and wide on your social media. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram. And if you need support but don't know where to find it, visit takebackthenight.org for a list of resources and how to reach our legal support hotline. Please remember that self-care is essential to healing and thriving.
Thanks so much, Claire. And again, thank you, Ben. And we will connect our listeners with your bio and your work. So everyone who's listening, please continue to tune in to the Dear Katie podcast for finding strength and healing. One day at a time, together, we will shatter the silence and end the violence. Thank you. Thank you again, everybody, for joining another episode of the Dear Katie podcast. I hope very much you found today's episode helpful, empowering, and a way to take another step in that long journey toward healing and supporting those we care about, learning about sexual violence prevention and also survivor support. For those of you who don't know, again, the Take Back the Night website has tons of great resources, books, self-care options, cool merch. If you're feeling like you need a wearable, we have great t-shirts. Of course, we would love it if you follow along on our free newsletter with news and events going on around the country and even around the globe. And finally, don't forget to like us and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You'll find our entire community popping up here and there, and recaps of our podcast episodes as well. So together we shatter the silence, and together we end the violence. Take care.